If you've missed a show, the full audio library is at radiomd.com. And now back to you, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. As the announcer said, we've got a great guest for you. Dr. Yvonne Hunt is a PhD and MPH program director at the National Cancer Institute's Tobacco Control Research Branch. And within the Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences, obviously, tobacco is a major cause of cancer, as well as of heart disease, stroke, memory loss, impotence, wrinkles of your skin, and a whole bunch of other things. She also holds, as I said, a MPH from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Illinois. She doesn't know one of the questions I'm going to ask her. She doesn't know any of the questions I'm going to ask her, but one of them I'm going to ask her in the second part. So we have two segments with her. We're lucky enough she'll be back in the second segment after our break in the middle of this. But we're going to talk to her about her clinical psychology and the behavior modification. What can we do to get more people to do the five behaviors that have been shown to prevent 80 to 90% of chronic disease in both the Swedish men's study and the nurses health study in the U.S. But before we do that, she's been working on a similar problem focused on tobacco. Yvonne, if I may call you that, or Dr. Hunt, I guess I'll do it more formally. We've gone from roughly 45% of smokers in 1960 to around 18% now. Why has it taken so long, and what can we learn from that about going the rest of the way from 18% to 5% or below?
Well, I mean, that is the million-dollar question. You know, the progress that we've seen has, as you said, has been tremendous. And part of that has been due to education. People, before 1964, people really weren't aware of all the devastating health effects of smoking. And today, most people do know something about the health effects, although even today, people don't fully understand what all of the ramifications of smoking are for health. And so, you know, we can do better educating people about what smoking does to their bodies. And we also have made considerable progress through research, which is what the National Cancer Institute funds. Tobacco control research has taught us a lot about what works to reduce smoking in the population. And as the years have gone by, we've applied some of those measures, and we've been able to keep youth from starting to smoke. So that's a big piece of it. We have to be able to prevent youth from becoming addicted in the first place. And we also have to help smokers quit. And if we do those two things, we can continue to drive down the smoking rates.
Now, one of the things, and I don't know whether this was your study or your data that was released several weeks ago, and I apologize for asking you about it if it wasn't yours. But one of the things was that if we raise the smoking age to, I guess it was 20, may have been 21 that was suggested. It may have been a study out of Bloomberg School and not out of NCI. That would have a radical effect. And I don't know whether that was just in the state of Ohio or whether that was throughout the country that was proposed.
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit more about that. The report that you're talking about was actually released by the Institute of Medicine. And the Institute of Medicine convened a committee for the purpose of reviewing all of the research that we have to date to help us understand whether raising the age, the legal age for which youth can purchase tobacco, to 21, whether that would have an impact on youth initiation. This was, you know, a testable question. Some states have done it, so we do have data, and they were able to look at the data and make a determination. So this panel of experts was convened, and they did determine that raising the age of purchase for tobacco up to 21 would have a major impact on reducing initiation of youth in this country. And so that's really sort of a landmark finding for prevention, because we are always trying to understand how to prevent youth from taking up smoking. Almost every smoker who's a smoker today began before they were age 18. They started as kids. And so, you know, the longer we can delay that, perhaps delay it indefinitely, the better. But we really needed the evidence to, you know, to show that that type of a policy would be beneficial. And this was evidence that we were waiting for.
And now, well, the IOM, the Institute of Medicine, doesn't do original research usually. So this was, they analyzed, I assume, data that was published or either in other countries or in our own area.
That's right. The Institute of Medicine, their role was to convene a panel of experts. And these experts in the field reviewed the existing literature on tobacco use initiation, the developmental biology and psychology of smoking uptake, and also the existing data on the tobacco policies that we have in the different states. And they were able to use some different modeling and statistical techniques to come to conclusions about how the age of tobacco use of legal access impacts youth initiation.
Now, one of the real interesting things is tobacco use has been a socioeconomic divider lately, meaning it is the less educated who smoke more, as I understand it. And correct me if I'm wrong. And so raising the age of first use would mean that a lot of people wouldn't learn in what I would call high school, and or in that early period. And that also would decrease, as I understand it, would decrease greatly the number of moms who smoke. Obviously, a lot of the people, the moms who do smoke, have picked it up in high school. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, almost everybody who's a current smoker did pick it up in high school, at least high school or young adulthood. So that would include moms who smoke. And I think maybe what you're also alluding to is that the smoking rates among moms who are teenage moms, those rates are disproportionately high. So if you're a teenage mom, you're more likely to be a smoker than a teenager who's not a mom. And so, yeah, raising the age is one way to keep cigarettes out of the hands of those teens. And certainly for the you know, moms who are in high school or later in young adulthood, protect the fetus too.
And is there a national body that sets age, or is that a local state prerogative to set age on smoking? Buying smoking materials.
This is not my area of expertise, but I can tell you from the tobacco control perspective generally, the way it works is that the Food and Drug Administration has regulatory authority over tobacco products, and they have set a minimum legal age of 18, and that's federal.
When we come back, Dr. Hunt, we're going to talk about your area of expertise, since I've avoided that so far, which is in tobacco cessation and motivating people and how people get off of cigarettes. We'll come back in just a few minutes on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, and we'll also talk about how to motivate more people in general health choices.
don't miss a minute. Listen at your leisure, always online and on demand at RadioMD.com. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And this is You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Dr. Yvonne Hunt, the tobacco, I guess you're the director, the program director at the National Cancer Institute for Tobacco and the Tobacco Control Research Branch, who's an MD, PhD, and whose real expertise is in talking to us about quitting smoking. So first, Yvonne, I understand about 50% of all smokers try and quit each year. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right. And even more smokers than that think about quitting and want to quit, but they don't necessarily make an attempt.
Now, what percent of the attempts, in other words, the 50% attempt, what percent are done with a physician or with someone who has expertise in tobacco cessation?
Well, that you're getting right to the heart of the matter. For nearly all attempts, quitters do not try to seek out any sort of help. So only about 4% of people who try to quit each year actually use medication or counseling to help them.
Is that right? 4%? So it's really, I mean, and the success rate of people who use help is what compared to those who try and quit on their own?
Using help can double or even triple somebody's chances of quitting. And, you know, anybody who's ever tried to quit smoking knows that, you know, it's a tough road. And so those odds to be able to double or triple your odds is pretty significant when we're talking about a behavior that's so difficult to change.
And when you smoke, as I understand it, the people who smoke try and quit multiple times before they succeed. What's the average number?
The average number is about 4 to 6 times, 4 to 6 tries before it sticks. And that comes from, looking at a large body of research of clinical trials and also just observing people and, you know, who have tried to quit and asking them how many times. So, you know, for everybody, it's a little bit different. But I think the thing to keep in mind, if you're a smoker who has tried to quit and failed, the idea is to keep trying because, each attempt is a opportunity to learn about what to do differently next time. And, it really does sometimes take more than one try, sometimes a lot more tries.
Well, obviously, if the average is 4 to 6, most people aren't succeeding in one. And as you said, to me, one of the most interesting things, we do this, the Cleveland Clinic has done this both for its own employees, and we've gone from roughly a 15.6% smoking rate among our own employees down to under 6%, predicted based on our data to get under 2% in by 2020. But we also do it with a number of corporations. That is, they've had us as helpers in this process. And the lack of number of people, with some companies, you get a very good uptake who offer either large incentives for their employees to quit or who mandate no smoking in the immediate vicinity meaning inside their plant or around it. For other companies that just make it a voluntary program, I've been impressed with how few have come forward to try and get help. And that's why I've wondered about that 50%. So even, I mean, you must have some experience with this, Yvonne. What's the data on if a company offers a program for smoking cessation, what percent of their, and without a large financial incentive if they quit, what percentage actually do try and quit?
Well, we don't actually have that data. Often the data for insurance programs or company-sponsored programs that is proprietary. And to my knowledge, we haven't had a chance to look at that yet. But we certainly do know that when somebody is offered help, so either through, the company or through, let's say, a mass media campaign, such as the CDC has done with their TIPS campaign, where smokers are provided with, a message that says, here's how you can get help. People do take advantage of that. So it is a good way to, offering help is a good way to help smokers quit, letting them know that help is out there. But I think your point is that we would like to see more people respond to those offers when help is offered.
Yeah, I think it does depend a lot on the culture of the company. So we've had some companies, and I'm going to say their names because they allow me to do so. Lafarge, for example, has done the Cleveland Clinic plan, and Cleveland Clinic was a $2,000 incentive. With IBM, it was a little more than that, in fact, and in that is, they have a reduction in premiums by doing that of almost 30% of their insurance rates. And at least in those companies, we've been able to get a large uptake. With Lafarge, it's more than 40% of their smokers. With some other companies we've worked with, and I'm not going to give those names, where they haven't done an incentive, haven't made it smoke-free workplace, partially because they're afraid of people smoking in dangerous areas if they try and do it publicly. We've had 5% of smokers have tried to quit rather than 50% or 40% or 60%, which is common in some other companies. So I think it really does depend on both culture and a moving forward with a large program for the company as a whole in health. Tell me, there is a free way, so if people are listening and they have friends, there is a way of getting help through the CDC and through NCI that is free. What is that?
There are a number of free resources, actually, that are associated with the federal government, so people can know they're credible. It's a website, smokefree.gov, which is hosted by NCI. And there's also a mobile text message program, so if somebody wants to have the convenience of a quit coach in their pocket that's going to text them helpful tips, that is smoke-free text, and information about that can be found on the smokefree.gov website, and that's free as long as somebody has a text messaging program on their phone. And finally, 1-800-QUIT-NOW is the national hotline.
And through that, you can get a couple weeks, as I understand, of nicotine therapy to help you through it. Wonderful guest. Thank you, Dr. Yvonne Hunt. And again, you can go to the National Cancer Institute's website, NCI.gov, and find out more. And what's the overall website again for smoking cessation?
And it is smokefree.gov.